Ladies and AIs, Andy here, day 60 of the Inner Winner Show, a challenge I've given myself to do one podcast a day for an entire year. Today I'm talking to an awesome guest, Dennis Mortensen, the CEO of tech startup X.AI. We talk about how he's raised venture capital and started his own companies, whether AI will take over the world, how to bring your own startup ideas to fruition, and why walking is the cheat code to life.
Testing. How's the audio?
It sounds, I'll give it a 7 out of 10.
In a sparse WeWork meeting room, you get that -3 echo attached to it.
So Yeah, my girlfriend works from home, and at the moment she's sitting in this tiny, tiny room. We've tried to soundproof it as best we can, but like, holy crap, probably every 10 customers says there's a terrible echo.
Yeah, it is this what it is.
Hey, can't AI just automatically de-echo? Adobe Premiere does a pretty good job of automatically cutting that out.
Well, yeah. I saw on a similar subject a paper/video from NVIDIA yesterday for where you and me go on a Zoom call and really trying to figure out how to compress that to the degree where we can still kind of recognize each other, but we're still sending the full picture, say 30 frames a second back and forth. What they did was they sent a few markers back and forth, and then they will just create your face on each end. As in, it was a factor 10 in compression, because it wasn't really a compression. It was just really signals for what you might look like. Kind of like what you've seen neural nets do on Obama saying something he didn't say, but on your face. So the whole video call starts with a few reference frames on you, kind of like signing up for Face ID on your iPhone. Once those have been put in place, then they just send over really few signals on where did Dennis's mouth go or his eyes. And that was pretty amazing, as in very few kilobytes needed to be transferred for me to be able to kind of have a really high quality image. And they could really just scale it upwards in quality. It's just about really GPU power on each end.
Dude, this is going to get me so excited. I was so excited when Joe reached out to you and said, like, do you want to have this guy on your podcast? Because I was like, oh my God, you have no idea how many videos and YouTube channels that I follow about this stuff. I don't know if you've ever heard of a guy called 2 Minute Papers.
Yeah.
Yep. So I've watched everything he's ever, I'm not even going to try and say his name. I've watched everything like NVIDIA has put out. I don't know if you saw recently, they came out with a background noise removal algorithm.
No, I didn't.
Oh my God. Okay. I'm going to leave a link in the show notes below to this. There are people there with a hairdryer or a lawnmower going, the noisiest crap ever.
Yeah.
And they talk and you can barely hear what they're saying. And then they run this algorithm. It works. You have to have a, like the latest NVIDIA graphics cards. You have to have the ones that are capable of ray tracing and stuff like that because it uses the same algorithms. And while the hairdryer is going, as soon as they click a button, all of a sudden, you can't hear anything. Like, you can only hear their voice, and it's crystal clear, as if there was no fudgery going on. It does a perfect job of it. It's amazing. They've done other ones where they're, like, smashing a hammer on a table, and then as soon as they click the button, it just goes normal. And this works, like, in real time, obviously. You can use this on Zoom calls.
And that's obviously, I think, the major change of late, which is that there's been plenty of changes to digital material that we could do after the fact in the past. Some of it would take an hour. Some of it would be re-rendering a scene that will take 3 weeks. But it was mostly kind of post-production type software. Now, you and me on cheap-ass MacBooks can do this in real time. It's almost crazy talk when you think about it.
Yeah, I can't wait till we get to the point. I'm sure you've seen these videos, but for anyone listening, there's a ton of videos on 2 Minute Papers where he basically talks about AI research and all the stuff we're talking about here. We're at the point where you can just describe an image and half of these algorithms can just instantly, well, not instantly, but like pretty quickly give you a mock-up. So you can say like a red car driving down a street with a stop sign in the distance, and the AI would just generate that image for you. They can also do this with video. I don't know if you've seen a couple of his recent videos lately where you will kind of paint an outline of an area and you say like, I want there to be a car here. I want there to be a road here. And then it generates a video of a car driving down a road and you can like patch areas out and the algorithm will automatically say like, okay, I'm going to turn that into a tree. I'm going to turn that into another car. This stuff is getting scary good.
Yes, it is. It's amazing.
Man, I was so excited to have you on here. Are you an AI researcher? Is that where your background comes in? Like, where did you start with all of this? How'd you get into AI?
That's a good question. And you and me could spend perhaps the next half hour trying to define AI or find some sort of compromise for where enough people within the umbrella that you and me kind of define would say, I could sign up for that. Now, if I go look back, I took my computer science degree 24 years ago, and all of my career have been in startup, and all of my startups, having spent about 5 years on each, have been very data-centric. So what we might have talked about as analytics in some time period would have turned into perhaps predictive analytics at some point, which might have turned into AI at this very moment. Perhaps the moniker doesn't matter as much, given that we just had this very dramatic progress, both on, in some degree, the algorithms themselves or the models that we try to assemble, but certainly also on the access to compute, for where we could imagine plenty of things 20 years ago, we just couldn't really execute on it. We certainly couldn't execute on it in real time as some of the things that we just talked about. I said that would just be completely crazy. I said we would set up some sort of server farm to run an experiment and see whether some particular prediction could be made. And that would be minutes, hours, sometimes days later. But my whole journey has been one of trying to extract meaning from data.
Like a data scientist.
Yeah. And if at some inflection point, we try to kind of build a business on top of it.
Yeah, I love that. One extra thing I'll add in there. Not only do we have the computing resources to do this in real time at this point in time, but that's also readily accessible to the average consumer. Okay, you need to have a little bit of money to buy the latest graphics card, but like not really. What, $500? $1,000? That's insane. That technology is now readily available. And I don't know if you've seen, there's apps already out. There's one called ReFace.
Yeah.
So you take a photo of your face and it will stick you onto, they've got pre-made clips.
Yep.
So they have like a Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man. They have like a Thor one. They have different, like a Vin Diesel one. And it will stick your face from your shitty camera selfie onto that. And some of them look crazy real. I played around with it myself. Some of them are amazing. And that's on your goddamn phone. Obviously, they're uploading it and doing it on their own servers. But the fact is, this is readily available now to consumers. And that's only going to happen more and more over the next like 5, 10, 15 years.
And I think I might just add the distinction between what you and me can buy, as in some CapEx cost, for where we don't even think about it like that as consumers. It's just whether I have $500 in my pocket or not. But just in general, you don't even need to buy anything in this day and age. And you and me just take this whole idea of cloud compute for granted, but it's actually no more than really a decade ago before we started to get access to the most kind of rudimentary cloud compute. But today, you and me can spin up 50 some odd instances on Amazon or your favorite kind of cloud compute and run an experiment over the next 40 minutes and close them down. Before that, well, that would have been an experiment to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars, but we can just spin it up and see, that's actually not what I wanted. I'll close it down, work on it more later this week once I kind of figured out this particular dilemma. And that, I think, fully democratizes access to it. For it's not just about who can come up with at least that initial financial backdrop to buy 100 servers. Because if I look back at my first two ventures, we ran 100 servers in the basement. And that would just be normal. And if you raise capital for any one of your ventures, you'll go out, find $5 million, the first $2 million, you'll spend on infrastructure. Today, if you do any new venture, as in Dennis and Andy, we team up, we raise a little bit of capital, and the first thing we do is spend $800,000 on servers, our investors will call exactly 30 minutes later saying, what the fuck? What are you guys doing?
Yeah.
Couldn't you just have spun up a set of instances instead? And of course, we should.
I can't wait to see where this is going. Even just on a more low level, because you're talking about like big, you know, ventures and stuff like that. I think cloud computing is obviously going to be more and more important in the future. There's already like Google Stadia. It's a little shitty at the moment, but like using cloud computing to play video games.
Yep.
If you don't have a good computer, like I'm on a laptop, I can go into Google Stadia, literally use their servers. There is lag issues at the moment, but for certain games, it works perfectly fine. As long as your internet is reasonably fast.
Yep.
You only need an internet connection, and you can also do this on your damn phone. I can't wait to see how centralized we take this. And if we get to a point where, apart from a few fringe cases, you don't really need your own computer anymore. You can kind of just do everything from a smartphone. Maybe you hook up like a Bluetooth keyboard and a Bluetooth mouse, and you can kind of have maybe a screen. So you don't need anything more than a cheap laptop or a cheap phone.
See, that's an interesting discussion to have, for where I will probably, even in my kind of inner monologue, kind of have that pendulum swing back and forth, for where there's a set of really strong arguments for why the phone or laptop or really any computer device we have is nothing but a screen and some bandwidth attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
And any kind of compute will happen somewhere else. And that compute we can kind of scale up and down as we need it. That's certainly a likely future. And it's probably, as I see, the more likely future. Then there's the other version, which is for you and me to at least dream of any form of privacy. We should be both able to do this on our own personal devices without it leaving this room. And that should be an option. I just think it's almost too wasteful to put all that juice into that laptop for only to kind of see me use it once in a while. As in, there's been, you and me have read about this for ages, plenty of experiments where you're trying to extract all this compute that just sit on desks from 6 p.m. till the next morning,
mm-hmm.
doing really nothing. Surely there'll be some energy extracted from you kind of having them turned on and do what they're supposed to do, but that seems like a complete waste, for where most data centers don't run at the same level of waste. It's kind of like...
Economies of scale.
Yeah, for where, I can't remember the latest studies, but I think you drive your car somewhere between 5 to 8%, and the remainder of the time, it just stands still.
Yeah.
And it's the same with your laptop. But putting all that aside, I do think, and I'm as optimistic and as positive as you are, but there's certainly a question around where do we get this data? Who's labeling it? So once we kind of gone beyond this first wave, where what we could extract from really what was readily available, and we kind of hit some sort of ceiling, there'll be a next step for where we probably need to figure out where do we go source a new pool of data, which is not just the videos uploaded to YouTube or where else I might extract this data. And if I just take my own example, we spent kind of half a decade trying to figure out how to carve out a corner of the language universe so we could create these intelligent agents that can schedule meetings. And that sounds almost naively simple. But given language is not a solved science, just to kind of give you some scope, in a small startup like ours, we had about 100 people full-time doing nothing but labeling meeting scheduling emails for 4 years straight.
Jesus.
We do exactly. Jesus. I think that is the only proper response to that. But that is just to carve out a small corner. So we certainly see a lot of this magic, but there's plenty of it that was not as magical. It was just really a grind for a long period of time. Then, of course, from the end of it, you start to see some magic. And in my own little universe here, it is one for where you can say things for where we can now understand it. Hey, get me and Andy together in the afternoon, first week of December, for half an hour on my Zoom. And surely you and me can easily understand that, even with the kind of grammatical issues of my Danish English, but it's understandable. Getting a machine to understand that was a dramatic endeavor, which is not as sexy and romantic as the beginning of this conversation. That was just day in and day out.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm going to sound like a boomer saying this, but I'm 33 myself, not quite boomer, but I can remember when the internet first came out and we first had search engines, before Google even, like Ask Jeeves and stuff like that. Just to get the computer or just to get the search engine to understand what you were saying was an absolute nightmare. You had to learn about how to use keywords. You had to phrase your question or your search query 5 different ways or 20 different ways, and you would get a different result. So if I said dog toys in Melbourne, that would give me a different search answer. Like I'd get a different search result than if I said toys for dogs in Melbourne. And so you had to play around with the keywords, the order of the keywords, which keywords you used to try and get the damn computer to understand what you were saying. That is such a novel problem at this point in time. And that's only what, like 20, 30 years later. I can't wait to see where we go in 20 or 30 years. You'll just be able to say the most basic human statement like Google. Like, okay, I'm going to go full science fiction here. In 50 years or 100 years, you'll be able to say, Google, I want you to make me happy. And then Google would just go, okay, I know exactly what you need right now. I've been analyzing your calendar. I've been watching all your movements. There's a security camera in the house, so I see everything you do. I know what time you go to bed. I know what food you like to eat. I know that today is a Wednesday, and usually on a Wednesday, you're a little sad because the news on Tuesday is like 43.9% more negative than it is any other day, and you watch the news, and that makes you sad. So I know on a Wednesday at 4 p.m., you need a chocolate bar. So you will say, I want you to make me happy. And Google will run like 50,000 queries right there and process all this big data and stuff. And then say like, here you go, here's your chocolate bar. I know that most people will say that's a weird dystopia and like, that's creepy. And how can Google know all that about you? But there is a science fiction part of me that's like, I really want that. That's so damn cool. Because I'm a technology guy above all else. I get really, really excited for this stuff. And I can't wait till we get to that kind of point. I know I'll probably be dead by the time we get there, but holy crap.
Let me attach 2 stories to that statement. The first one is perhaps where we're at. So you and me grew up on search engines for where we had to change. They were mostly keyword driven. So if I wanted to do something, I needed to imagine what type of keywords could I see a web page use so that I can find that web page who might help me do the action I want to take.
It's like you had to empathize with the computer's brain, whereas now we're trying to get the computer's brain to empathize with our brain.
Very much so. And we probably reached the point now for where I am brave enough to assume that I can ask a question, or at least ask simple questions, not complex ones, and the search engine would be able to provide an answer to that. How old is Barack Obama? And how many days in November? And instead of that being a set of keywords and me trying to find a page that might hold the answer, they can just give me the answer straight away. What they cannot do is take an action, or perhaps better phrased, do a job for you. So again, I can use my own kind of small example here for where the 2 intelligent agents that we engineered that can schedule meetings. What I don't want is really a chit chat. I have a small, well-defined job, which I want the agent to do, which is get Dennis and Andy on the phone early next week for 10 minutes. Well, that's a job I can define in natural language. And then the agent needs to both be able to understand the request, but also hold the ability to do the job I wanted it to do. Now, that is, for me, super exciting, because that means we move away from trying to find information to that of describing little jobs we want done. And in the end, most of the time, what we want done are little jobs. Now, in that kind of one bucket of getting to that scenario, there is also this new kind of interesting setting for where Andy and Dennis will experience recommendation engines across the internet 8 times a day, every day, 7 days a week. So will my mom. She's just not aware of it. She'll just turn on Netflix and assume, well, here's a list of movies that I can see. Well, that's not really a list of movies. That is a recommendation engine who's trying to optimize for some particular outcome. Probably you staying a customer, and they figured out that the more movies you watch, the less the churn. So they need to figure out the best movies they can show you at this very moment. They'll have you click them. Now, the other side of that recommendation engine, if you really think about it, is the fact that you are being manipulated. So perhaps these are not recommenders. These are manipulation engines. And if you really think about it in that view, you and me are being manipulated into settings that we might not be aware of every single day. And that, I think, will be even more difficult to spot once we move to new UIs. So you and me probably grew up on the graphical user interface for the most part, if not the command line. My kids grew up on the kind of mobile UI or touch UI. But I think the next generation might grow up on some version of the conversational UI. Now, in the conversational UI, there's just less space to show you how we ended up with this answer. There's actually less alternative because you and me grew up with 10 results. And I'll pick one which I believe is not overly biased. And you and me can actually scan the results and know what's spam and what's not.
Yep.
In the conversational UI, you'll just get the answer, not knowing, well, what was the probability of this particular answer being the one that you read out to me? What was the second one? Why am I not hearing that? Is there one? That, I think, is going to be a very interesting UI UX challenge that comes attached to AI if they're not to turn just straight manipulation engines, which is not where we want to go. And I think we've seen that from other kind of social platforms when things kind of go wild.
Yeah, there's a whole field of ethics that hasn't even been invented, like that hasn't fully been dived into yet. We have to work out the ethical answers to all these dilemmas. There's also a safety issue there as well. I don't know if you know a guy on YouTube called Robert Miles. He originally started on Computerphile. He talks about AI safety and how it can go wrong. And he's kind of playing devil's advocate there. That's the whole point of his channel. But for instance, if we say to an AI, tell me if you had any of these issues. I don't know if you did, but your AI obviously plans calendars and says like, okay, Dennis is free on this time, this day. These are his options. Andy is free these times, these days, his options. And then the AI goes like, okay, how can I find a good time slot for both of them? One of the issues with AI safety is sometimes when you give a command to an AI, like you say, Dennis and Andy want to have a meeting at the same time. The AI can go like, okay, my only prerogative, my only mission is to put those two on a Zoom call together at the same time. How about I just clear their calendars and delete everything else they have, and then their whole week is free and they can both have a call? Or if you were to tell Google, make me happy, Google goes, okay, Andy wants to be happy. Heroin makes people feel happy. I'm going to order him a lifetime supply of heroin and just make him inject himself for the rest of his life. Now he'll be happy. There's always room for like fuckery, so to speak. Did you have any challenges like that when you were setting your calendar AI up?
So there's two parts. There's the potential bias that comes attached to the data that you either labeled yourself or are training on in some unsupervised setting. And then there is the objectives that you try to optimize towards. We happen to be in a pool of data that is not super sensitive towards biases. As in, it's very hard to argue for what particular bias got attached to the fact that we speak Wednesday morning or one Tuesday afternoon. So that is really just the particular vertical that we're in. Now, on the objectives, you actually described one of the things that we've looked at for the longest period of time, but it's a super scary territory, which is when we start to cancel meetings on your behalf, as in, who do you meet with? To do that, you really have to start to apply a importance score. So we actually have a set of strong signals for how important you find people. And it comes right out of your calendar. So we can see things such as, how quick are you to book a meeting with certain people? The quicker you are to book a meeting, the higher the likelihood it is that you find them important. If you choose your default settings, as in, if Dennis always does 40-minute meetings, but he did a hour and a half meeting with Andy, I'm trying to say something here, perhaps without saying it out loud, that I find Andy important. If I moved two other meetings around, to make room for Andy. If I did it sooner rather than later, if I reschedule, all of these are signals for we can start to score people for how important they are. Now, if I know how important people are, I can take more important people and move less important people around. That is an interesting territory to be in, because we are now the judge of who meets who and when. We've not been super comfortable in entering that territory. So we actually don't automatically cancel and reschedule meetings. We do it on your command. So we've been very much about being the mechanics. Tell me what to do, and I do it. So you're the boss here. But there's certainly some very interesting optimization that you can do. And I'll just provide an example here, which kind of goes into the kind of superhuman territory. So say Dennis has 3 meetings in Midtown next week, Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And I'm downtown. It'll take me half an hour up, half an hour back. That's 3 hours of commute. But what if I could put all those meetings on Wednesday, 1, 3, and 5? I have to go to Midtown, same week, meet the same people, but with 1 hour of commute. I certainly have a much better life with less commute meeting the same people. That's super hard to do because we're at the mercy of the guest calendar. And if I need to move his events around, then his guests need to move their events around. And there's this kind of cascading set of effects where you might need to touch thousands of the calendars to make this happen. But that's some sort of network optimization. It's kind of like once all the cars are self-driving, then you can start to do city optimization, not just optimization for the individual car driving down the road. That is certainly very alluring territory. We just haven't touched it yet. And you and me could talk about that for hours again.
Yeah.
What are the dangers and why should you and why shouldn't?
Like I said, the technology guy in me wants that to happen. I can see all the dangers that come with that and the ethics. Because what you're talking about is essentially a form of mind reading, or you could phrase it like that. Your AI in particular, it looks at all the data it gets, and then, as you said, it figures out how important you think the other people are. That's already a form of mind reading. It's essentially trying to predict what you want. That's kind of mind reading. And it will analyze data that you hadn't thought about yourself, because we all have intuitive feelings. Like, I intuitively feel like, oh, Dennis is important because we're going to talk about AI and I'm super excited about that. I really want to have this guy. But I don't voice that. I don't even necessarily say that to myself. It's kind of sitting there in my gut. It's like a gut feeling. It just comes out as an emotion, excitement. And the AI has to, in a very logical and rational way, figure all this stuff out, very like cold and clinical. And I think people find that kind of creepy, this mind reading part, analyzing the data. I think people find it autistic, might be the right word, autistic or overly analytical or too cold and clinical. And I think people like to be in control of their own lives. You know, it's that saying, that quote, I'm the captain of my ship, I am the master of my fate. And people can find predictive AI, especially AI like Google and all that sort of stuff, that's trying to predict your future behaviors and your future wants and needs. People find that creepy. I personally love that shit, but I can see why people find it creepy. And I think maybe the answer is more education. I think that that is one thing that someone like Google, we'll just focus on Google. I think Google doesn't do a good enough job of explaining how this stuff works. It just says, oh, look at this cool thing that we can predict what you want tomorrow. We can, like with Google Now and stuff, predicting what you're going to want in an hour or two. I don't think they do a good enough job of explaining to people how they're coming about that information. And I think the average person just finds it weird and creepy. They're like, oh, how does Google know that about me?
So there's a whole field of study around explainable AI. Again, we should certainly talk about that. But if I just make that very tangible, what we see in our support tickets the most are what we call perceived errors. So not technical errors or incorrect predictions, but perceived errors. As in, why did you do this at 4? Why didn't you do it the day before? Or why do I have this meeting happening the week after that constraint I asked you for? And they then think we are in error. Now, that whole idea of being able to explain your action, we have invested heavily in. And sometimes it's the smallest of things, which is hey, I asked you to set up a meeting tomorrow, but you did it the day after. I do know I have an hour slot tomorrow. Why didn't you slot it in there? Hey, Andy, remember, you told us that you don't want back-to-back meetings and that you need breather time in between meetings. That means there's some sort of invisible set of guardrails around them, so we could not slot it in. Oh, yes, you're right. Thank you very much. Hey, Dennis, I asked for a hour-long meeting next week. You booked it from 5:30 to 6:30, but I told you that I don't do meetings after 6 o'clock. How hard can it be? How much AI do you need to put in place to do an if-then statement on whether this is later than 6? Hey, we actually spent nearly a year trying to implement these common sense rules around when we are allowed to stretch your scheduling hours so that if somebody comes in, say from Hong Kong, is only in New York for a day, you're probably both willing, able, and eager to meet your friend. And that is what we did here, because he's actually only in town for one day. Oh, interesting. Awesome. I didn't know you did that. Surely I want to keep the meeting intact. So we really tried to engineer all these kind of moments where, can I now explain to you why I did something that you didn't expect me to do? And that whole kind of explainable AI field of study is super interesting. For us, it's really mostly about making sure that we keep our customers happy. And I'm not sure many people will cry themselves to sleep if Dennis churn one of his customers. I might, but other people not so much. I think it's more on other types of predictions. Well, why didn't Dennis get that particular credit card, but Andy did? Why didn't Dennis get that particular mortgage, but Andy did? Why didn't Suzanne get parole, but Tom did? And there's a certain set of predictions for where not only would I like to know, it seems only decent to describe why is it that we suggested one thing over another. And you and me have been in plenty of scenarios, even in this day and age, October 2020, for where we would decline something, for where I don't think the machine got that right.
Yeah.
I'm a little bit bitter now, but hey, I'm not going to bitch about it. But I actually think you got it wrong. And I see this all the time. So I'm obviously not from around here. So I'm not really, I grew up in a society for where you assemble a good profile by savings versus say the US, where you assemble a good financial profile by assembling a credit story. So we kind of have opposite upbringings. So that means my upbringing for where I use a debit card for most things, well, that doesn't give me really a good credit story in the US. So that means I have this kind of story to tell people all the time for where, hey, I got a few monies in my pocket. I think I'm reasonably trustworthy, but we now have to kind of tell that story. So there's just plenty of these where we would want the machine to tell us why it did one thing over another.
Yeah. I'm going to come back to that because I have a couple of questions I wrote down while you were talking. But first, I want to ask you, because I know that my listeners, my podcast is generally focused around self-improvement, financial, dating, fitness, all that kind of stuff, improving your life. I want to hear from you, your first couple of stories that you hinted at before, your first couple of ventures. I want to hear about servers in the basement, how that came about, how you raised capital. How does one even raise capital? For someone like me, that just seems insane. The numbers you're talking about, like millions of dollars and stuff. Walk us through that story.
So I've done two prior ventures that were entirely bootstrapped and two prior ventures that were traditional venture-backed companies where you raise millions of dollars.
Yep.
And the current venture is also a VC-backed startup. Now, whatever side you're on, it always looks slightly greener on the other side. So if you're now bootstrapped, plenty of people will dream of, oh, if somebody deposited a $2 million check in my bank account today, I would be happy.
Yep.
Now, the guy who just received that check will dream of the days where I didn't have to do investor updates and sit in board meetings and do all sorts of other things, right? So
yeah.
No matter what side you're on, you have dreams of what's going on the other side. Now, I'll have opinions on both sides, and I think they are equally exciting, but very different stories. On the raising capital side, if you're raising traditional venture capital, what most people might not know, plenty of people, certainly those who start to kind of go out and work it will immediately kind of find out, but perhaps some of your listeners don't know, is that really only billion-dollar outcomes are worth listening to. Now, that sounds ridiculous, as in, if Dennis and Andy can go to the basement, work on something, and get to $40,000 in monthly recurring revenue, we've done something pretty awesome. But that is just not really an investable story. This is a great story of how Dennis and Andy are living good lives and put together some nifty software and are making a few monies off of it. Awesome. Now, the venture industry is based on them raising money from some limited set of partners or family offices or what have you. And they then go and invest that into 20 companies. They expect the vast majority of those companies to go belly up, as in that investment will be an immediate write-off. Take 1, 2, 3, 4 years for them to go tits up. Then one or two of them will go sideways, and one, perhaps two, will be winners. Those one or two winners will need to pay for all of the remainder and all of the years to get there for we didn't make any money. And that needs to be an outsized outcome. So if they invest in companies that can't create an outsized outcome, well, why am I investing? So that is certainly the first part of the story where you need, at least to yourself, to be able to kind of paint some sort of picture where over a long enough period of time, this can turn into a billion-dollar company. And if you don't have that narrative down, it's just not investable. Then, of course, you should try to figure out, how do I then go from it's just Dennis and Andy who quit their jobs, got together, wrote some software, have an MVP, and a few kind of pilot customers. What is the story between here and you and me ringing the bell on the New York Stock Exchange? We need to be able to kind of describe that story. Now, even though how ridiculous it might sound, is why are you forced to describe that story? Because the investors aren't buying what you have. It doesn't matter that we craft a little bit of revenue. They need to kind of see the end of it.
Yeah, they're buying your future.
They're buying your future. And then, of course, if they buy that future, you need to come up with three parts and they'll invest in one of those three parts. It's an awesome team. It's an awesome idea. It's an awesome market. Sometimes they want all three or just one of them, or they invest in one over the other. If they invest very early, really, most of what they invest in is just the team. That Dennis and Andy, they're awesome people. Whether the idea of the market is spot on at this very moment, that doesn't matter. They're just awesome makers. They'll make something of this. So we'll write them a quick 500K seed check and off to the races with them.
That's fascinating, because that's the one metric that I wouldn't have... I'd never sat down and thought about it. The team thing would have felt like the least important thing to me. I would have assumed the idea is what matters most and the team doesn't really matter. If you have a great idea, the team doesn't really matter. I'm sure you're going to say, yeah, if the idea is good enough, the team doesn't matter as much. But I'd never come at it from that angle of thinking like investors would give you money just for being a great team, even without an amazing idea, because they can see some potential in you. I guess it's like that TV show Shark Tank, if you've seen that, where they give money because they like you and they think that you have something. And okay, this guy or this team is going to go somewhere with this. How does one find a VC investor? Not that I'm going to go out and find a VC investor myself, but this is a fascinating world to me. I know there's websites like AngelList where you can kind of put your project up there and people will give, but that's like small time stuff. How does someone find, is there a website? Is there a newspaper ad? Are there secret meetings? How do you find an investor?
So we can start with AngelList, which will have a database of most investors. Actually, all of the serious investors are on AngelList. That doesn't necessarily mean that you'll use that platform to raise capital, but it's certainly a platform for where you can find all of the investors in New York or Austin or San Francisco or London. So you should think of this, if you're going out trying to raise capital, really as a sales process. So if you and me go sell anything, really, a piece of software, well, we craft a sales funnel where we assume we need to speak to more people than we actually end up closing on. simply because anybody which we call on won't end up buying our product. And it's the same with investors. And those you call on in the sales process, you should try to at least do some form of qualification. So let's say that you and me want to raise capital for a piece of enterprise SaaS software. Then we should go find investors who invest in software, probably SaaS software, in the enterprise space and at the seed level. Some people write $500K checks, some write $5 million checks, and some write $40 million checks. So we need to do at least the most basic of qualification, as in, do they even invest in people outside of their geography? As in, yeah. Why are you trying to raise capital from Danish investors? That is silly. So in that regard, we can put together a list of 70-some odd investors. And I'll give you just some numbers from when we raised our B round. So you raise capital in kind of stages. So typically the yep. first few monies in, people will call friends and family. You raise perhaps $100,000 or $40,000. Then you raise a seed round. Let's call that $500,000 to $2 million. Then you raise an A, B, C, D, E, F round. And then you do the IPO. Most people along this journey die. All of us pretty much die along this this journey. And that's fine. That is the most likely outcome of a startup. Now, as you raise the seed round in this particular example, you'll probably add some number of leads to the top. But as I said, for my B round, I think I added 70 investors to the top. I actively pitched 22. I had negotiations with 7, and I ended up with 3 term sheets, which is that kind of final contract where they agree to give me X number of dollars and I agree to surrender X number of shares. But that was the funnel that I needed to put in place. And I probably spent somewhere between 70 and 90 days on it, almost full-time work.
Essentially, what you're talking about is like playing a numbers game. Like everything in sales is, if you want something, you have to apply to a bunch of places. I think people have this concept of, I will just find the perfect venture capitalist and they will give me the money, the perfect investor, and they'll give me the money and it'll be a beautiful team together. And it's like, there's a process, just like getting a job. You have to apply to a lot.
And what's demoralizing for many people is that all they read about in the press are the success stories.
Yeah.
But there is 1,000 stories where people didn't make it before the success story. But it looks like anybody can take a trip to San Francisco, walk up and down Sand Hill Road and pick up $1 million and go home and get started. But that's just not really what happens. It is just a lot of work. And I think it should be a lot of work. There's certainly people who would want only the best people to end up with funding. Now, as you do this, I would at least make sure you have also convinced yourself that this cannot happen unless I get external capital. Many times what you need is perhaps some capital, but it doesn't need to be venture capital. There was a time where if you wanted to start a business, you went to your bank.
Yes.
And you tried to get a loan and you put in place some room for you to get started. And then over time, you paid that back and you own that company outright. And I would certainly suggest most people convince themselves this cannot happen. As in, I cannot see myself pay for 5 years of R&D to create this new form of battery, which I think we can then bring to market. That is a gamble. And for that, we need venture capital, who's willing to make gambles, and they accept the fact that it's probably not going to work. But there's plenty of other businesses for where, oh, this is just good software. No, we know we can make it. It's not a gamble. It's about executing on it. And I figure out the pain. I have the first 2 customers lined up. I come from the industry. I can live off of cash flow. And if I look at my third venture, which we did out of Budapest, that was financed entirely on cash flow. As in, we make some good software, we sell it to a customer, they give us a few monies, we keep one for a rainy day, I take another 9, go hire a new engineer, and we build it up to about 70 people, just off of straight cash flows. And when we sold it to Yahoo, we owned it outright. As in, no need to send, you know, any check back to your investors. You are the investor, or your customers were really your investors, if you think about it.
Quite a lot of my my listeners and my audience are very like entrepreneurial, very self-driven guys. And a lot of them have ideas. Either they'll have an idea for an app, or they'll have an idea for a small business or something like that. And I think one of the biggest struggles is convincing people to borrow a little bit of money, especially from the bank, to get their idea started. Like whether you need to borrow a couple of $1,000 to pay someone to code your app idea for you if you don't know how to program. You obviously, with your calendar AI, you said you had hundreds of people or 100 and something people working for you. Did you do much programming yourself in the early days on your first couple of ideas? Or you don't have to give an actual number, but like, did you borrow money to outsource and delegate and get other people to help you? Because I think that's one of the biggest struggles that my guys have is, should I borrow some money? Like even we're just talking $5,000, $10,000 to get this idea off the ground, or should I just kind of let it sit there and say, I don't have $10,000, therefore I can't do this idea. I see a lot of ideas wasting away in the trash can because they're too scared to go for it.
So I've always been able and willing to invest my own capital. So for my very first venture, that was a straight bank loan. As in, I went to the bank, I pitched the idea, and I sold my mom on signing off on the loan should I not be able to pay it back. It was not a staggering amount, but certainly something for where my mom wouldn't have been overly jolly about having to pay that back on my behalf. But it was not something where, well, now she's going to lose the house. It was just one thing for where, hey, Dennis, man up. This is on you. I trust you here. So that was how I got started. I was so lucky that my very first venture ended up on the right side of the dot-com boom. So I sold that tech venture in April 2000, and we owned it. So I made a pot of money early on in my life, and I've been able to kind of then invest. And of the 4 prior ventures we've done, we had 3 exits. So you end up with a few monies in your pocket. So I've always been able to kind of finance the beginning of new ventures. And I'll be super honest, for the last venture, just to get us started, I persuaded 3 friends to kind of join me. I wrote the first $100,000 check myself. And then that was enough for us to kind of go work a little bit. And I did the same for this venture. And I fully understand not everybody can write that check. But I would say 2 things to it. It doesn't have to be. And that's because I immediately wanted to kind of get my friends on board. Many times, plenty of friends will support you. They can't quit their jobs immediately. But I would highly encourage that you spend a few monies, if for nothing else, not enough to kind of you, your girlfriend, your wife, your kids, whatever, need to kind of leave the apartment or your house. But you might not need 2 cars. Hell, you might not need a car at all. And sometimes there are real luxuries in your life, and they'll sum up to, you know, some amount. And you should kind of look at that and say, what do I want the most? Do I want to drive from here to there, or do I want to take the subway? Well, now we can just make a call. Well, I find driving more pleasant than me doing this app idea. Well, then you made the decision. And that is okay. But I think many times, if you're really honest with yourself, there's actually things you could kind of flip around if you really wanted to do it. That's the one part. So I rarely find people where they can't cut any deeper. They typically can, if they wanted it.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
Then the second part is, you should try, and I know I'm saying this as a, you know, with a computer science degree, it is not rocket science. As in, if you went to a code academy, pick any language. Let's take JavaScript just for the fun of it. they come in these...
JavaScript is so ridiculously easy to learn.
As in, not only easy to learn, you'll find it fun.
Yep.
As in, I did it with my daughters over the summer, years back, to kind of get them exposed to it. As in, they're really just little puzzles. Don't think of it as programming, because when you look at it from afar, it looks like, that is not for me. That is completely impossible. I don't understand it. Well, that's just because we have this distinct syntax that kind of keeps people out until they touch it. It's kind of like looking at math, thinking, oh, that's not for me. But I really encourage you, forget about whether you have something you want to program up tonight. Just the next 2 months, spend like 15, 20 minutes, two or three nights a week. You'll do that JavaScript course for free, by the way. And come the end of it, you'll say, damn, you know what? I can actually code. When people ask me, I can actually tell them I can code, because you can. And it doesn't take any more than that. You're not going to be the best programmer in the world, but you'll be able to slap the first prototypes together. You might even need to kind of hire some real people when you go to market to kind of put this in production. But you can actually write the MVP, start to get some test customers, and it'll be super fun, I guarantee you. Sorry, it sounds like I'm on a commission here, but I really encourage people to go try it out themselves.
Yeah, mate, you're preaching to the choir. I taught myself to code, completely taught myself to code. I learned JavaScript. I've played around. Especially, you can start really easy and start with something where you can see instant results. A good example of that is something like AutoHotkey, which lets you mess around and make custom scripts that can run on Windows. I think it also works on Mac and stuff like that. But you get instant feedback. You don't have to learn all the sort of syntax of JavaScript. It's a lot easier syntax. You can play with hotkeys, and you can make it, when I hit, I don't know, Control Shift A in this app, I want you to write a sentence for me. And the code will automatically like put that sentence just from that hotkey. So that's what I mean when I say instant feedback. But learning JavaScript or any other language is super easy. There are so many YouTube tutorials online for free that will take you from step one, I've never coded, all the way to the end.
And I know when you and me say this, there'll be listeners here who will immediately say, sure, yes, you're able to, I get it. But you're not convinced, and I empathize with that. But of all the things I've tried, and I'm not affiliated with the Code Academy at all, but I did it on 2 10-year-old girls. And it comes in these super tiny increments where you can work on it for 4 minutes and you get just a little bit of gratification. Oh, that's nice. And if you're not up for that, then I might suggest you do kind of this whole, what people call no code movement, where you can actually put a lot of stuff together without any code. So you should look at, say, platforms like Zapier, where you can start to glue things together from around the internet. So you can glue, my product is part of that glue, but you got thousands of tools. When an email comes in, I wanted to kind of create a field in this spreadsheet, and I wanted to send out a text message. And you can actually glue things together through a kind of drag and drop. That is super interesting as well. And there's a whole kind of movement behind that, and plenty of people who are working on creating kind of mini products by gluing other people's product together.
Yeah, it's like if you were making a game, you can use, there's a tool called Game Maker, which you basically don't need to know any coding. It's like completely graphical. You get to just drag and drop things around there. I think coding has this big barrier to entry where people think like, oh, I'm not smart enough. I'm not nerdy enough. You know, I'm a sporty guy. I can't be learning coding. That's like nerd stuff. But once you actually start, it's like you say, you can, in the first 5 minutes, you can get the code to do something and you go, holy crap, I just made that happen. I think there's a big barrier to entry to coding. There is in a lot of things with life. For me personally, and I know for a lot of guys, the gym, being strong and fit, just being fit in general, that had a big barrier to entry for me. I was like, I can't go to the gym. That's only big buff guys and buff girls. They're all stronger than me. I'm weak. I can't even do a push-up. I'm kind of overweight and chubby and unfit. Once you get in there and you start, within like 5 minutes, you get some feedback. You start feeling your muscles are working. You sweat a little bit. You're like, okay, there's some feedback. Coding is exactly the same. You will get feedback within 5 minutes of starting coding. I promise. It's not such a big barrier to entry. And we're not talking about you have to be some super coder sitting there smashing the keys at 400 words per minute. That's the end result. You don't have to climb Mount Everest to be a competent coder. Just start, just muck around a little bit, have some fun. Coding is incredibly fun.
It's a good analogy. I like that.
So you mentioned in your notes, because you sent me some notes like before the call of stuff that we could talk about, and you said entrepreneurship can be a lifelong career. That's exactly how I feel about my content that I'm putting out and just self-improvement in general. But will you always be an entrepreneur? Do you think that you're always going to have that itch? Are you always going to have new projects that you want to work towards? Is there always like the next big hill for you to climb? Or do you think at some point you'll move on to something else and say like, okay, I'll just retire and, you know, I don't know, spend time with my family?
I like the analogy of entrepreneurship being perhaps similar to sports or professional sports, which is that you do it for the love of the game, not for the trophies. And
yeah,
if you do it for the love of the game, you might actually just win something in the end. So if you ask me, I'm not here at the office today because I must really just get my act together so I can pay the rent come the end of the month. No, I do it because I actually love what I am doing here. It just happens that I'm also getting paid for it and I can then pay my rent, but I really do it for the love of the game. So for me, this is not something for where I could imagine I would then do something else. I'm not sure what that else would be, as in retire. If I retire, well, that means I'll just sit in another place with a different laptop and a different Diet Coke and hack away. Well, then I'm still an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
I think my comment on entrepreneurship being a lifelong career is just at least trying to create some sort of conflict with the kind of West Coast saying of you're only an entrepreneur if you find some sort of calling for you cannot not do it. Then you do that venture and you're trying to kind of scale that to its max. And once done, then you run away and don't do it again. I don't think that's incorrect, but I like the idea of entrepreneurship as a career, which is that anything which you can do, one must somehow assume that you get better over time. And I think it's the same with entrepreneurship, that if I look back on many of the things I did in my first venture versus what I'm doing in my last venture, I would like to believe that I'm slightly better at the whole idea of startup today versus 20 years ago. So if you can somehow create a setting for where you can do entrepreneurship as a career, I highly recommend it. I find it extremely satisfying, which is that you can take these things that don't exist, create them out of thin air, and turn them into these little businesses. Some of them successful. You know what? Some of them not so successful. And that is okay as well. And if you do turn it into a career, then you can almost think of it as the kind of 50-year fund, for where you get to invest in probably 10 ventures over a lifetime, perhaps 15, depending on how some of the first ones go. And expect that 10, 12 of those 15 don't really pan out. Three of them will. You just need to kind of stick to it, be better and better. And sure, the first one, that won't work. The next one, that might not work either. Third one, we got some traction here. There's some real customers. My monthly recurring revenue kind of increases 4 or 5% month over month. Damn, we're 60% up this year. Ooh, there's a ton of feature requests. I think I'm going to be brave enough to kind of add another people, two people to the team. That is where it gets exciting. And then you might even be so lucky that, you know, you make a few monies off that venture. And then there's room to kind of go the next few ones. And we can talk about how you make some money in the end, whether you exit entirely, turn it into an entity that runs on its own and you're just the owner. But there's plenty of ways you can kind of make that happen.
As you're talking and I'm listening to you, I'm framing it all. My website and my philosophy and everything is in my podcast is dedicated to self-improvement. That's my number one cause. It's the thing I care the most about. It sounds exactly like entrepreneurship. I feel like we're talking the same language. We're just using a different word for it. Each one of your entrepreneurial projects sounds to me like self-improvement. Okay, you start here at the very start. You don't know what you're doing with this new project. You start building up. You start gaining some success. Maybe it fails. Maybe it doesn't. If it works, you add more people to the team. You have more challenges. There's more hurdles you need to jump over. You tackle those. You take it day by day. And eventually you get to a point where you're sitting atop the mountain and you look down and you say, holy crap, I remember when this project started as an idea in my head on a drunken Friday night with my friend Tom. And now look at how far we've come. That is exactly how I feel about self-improvement. You know, if it's fitness, you start out a fat, sloppy mess like I did, and you get to a point where you can deadlift 200 kilos and you have abs and people look at you and say, holy crap, you look good. And you remember the days where you were sitting at home feeling like a bit of a loser because you were fat and unhappy and unfit and nobody liked you and nobody was attracted to you. And I feel like we're speaking the same language. This is making me really excited. I mean, I'm not going to go out there and start a venture capital business or anything like that, but like we are speaking the same language here. And I can see why you say it's a lifelong thing, because I have an article on my website called Self-Improvement is a Lifelong Endeavor. And that's why your statement jumped out to me, because I was like, okay, this guy is just speaking my language here.
Couldn't agree more. The only, I wouldn't say word of caution, but the only footnote I might apply to this is that I would make sure, if you do turn entrepreneurship into a lifelong endeavor, you need to not attach the success of your venture to the worth of your life. As in, we have some ventures that are more successful than others, but I try to be equally happy whether I'm working on a venture that is going gangbusters or one that is not. And I've certainly seen plenty of people for where they are masters of the universe because their particular venture is going up and to the right. And if it's not, they are one click short of being outright depressive.
Yeah.
And I think you need to think of it again, and that's why I come back to my own kind of sports analogy. It's just a game. If I go home tonight and we've sold a customer at the office or not, my wife and my two girls, they still love me. It's all good. So in that regard, I'm just trying to kind of play the game to the best of my ability, have fun while doing it. Sometimes we win. I certainly play to win. And sometimes we don't, and that's okay.
Mate, you are preaching to the choir. So another part of advice I give to my audience is dating advice. And we have the concept of what we call the numbers game, which is exactly what you're talking about right here. If you walk up to a girl and say like, hey, you're cute. Like, I'm Andy. What are you up to? She might say, sorry, I have a boyfriend. You have to really fall in love with the game and the concept of enjoying what you're doing, exactly what, like what you just said, and not tie so much attachment to the outcome. If you walk up to a girl and she's not single, cool. Like, what does that matter? If you start an entrepreneurial endeavor, you start a new project and it fails in the first week because you realize the idea just can't be scaled, or you know, you missed something super important, or the world isn't ready, like whatever. You can't get too depressed about that. Like you say, you can't fall from the sky and hit the ground and say, oh my God, like I failed one time. You have to dust yourself off. Yeah, it's embarrassing. Yeah, it's humiliating. Yeah, maybe you do lose something. Just like if a girl rejects you in a bar and people see that, that's humiliating. Of course it is. But move on. Enjoy the game, as you just said yourself. Have fun playing it. Like there's a really great quote by Oscar Wilde, and he says, life is too important a thing to be taken seriously.
We're certainly in that Venn diagram of Dennis and Andy, there's a heavy overlap here, I see, because I have this story I tell people on what I want when I get to the end. And when I get to the end, all I want is really just a set of good stories.
Me too.
I can tell my kids and my grandkids and say, you know what? We had fun, didn't we? Damn.
Yes.
That was a crazy venture. Shit, that we shouldn't have done. But you know what? Some of the things that didn't work out, those are actually the best stories. And the ones that we laugh about the most. And the fact that we made a few monies along the way, that's almost insignificant, uninteresting, not part of the story. No, it's the stories themselves. That's all I'm really assembling here. Just a set of good stories.
I love that. The way I look at this is Essentially, there is a portion of time, a chunk of time that has been set aside for me, for Andy, for the entity called Andy. And I have from zero to, I don't know, roughly 80 years, 82.4 years, whatever the average is. That time is set aside for me. No matter what I do, that's right there. I have to live until the end of my life. Now that I'm stuck here on this planet, on this earth, with that time period, I may as well do something fun with that.
Yep.
I don't know what the meaning of life is. I don't claim to know. Anyone who does is lying to you. But my purpose that I have come up with is I'm going to fill every single one of those moments, which I have to live through anyway. I'm stuck. I'm going to try and fill those with as many fun memories and happy times, and I'm going to try and give back to other people and make sure they have as much fun as possible. I'm going to basically chase joy in every little moment that I ever can. And at the end, I want to sit there and be one of those old men who goes like, when I was your age, and then I just tell like 50 cool stories, right? Because my granddad had so many of those cool stories, and he used to tell me them all the time. A lot of other people would say like, oh, stop rambling, granddad. Nobody cares. But I loved those stories because I was like, this man's like lived a bunch of cool experiences. He's done a bunch of stuff he regrets, but a bunch of stuff he's really grateful for. He loved my Nana to death. That's what I want when I get to the end. A bunch of cool stories, like you said.
Hear, hear.
We didn't even talk about walking when we said we would talk about walking. Let's finish with that. How has walking changed your life? Because you told me that you like walking. And as soon as you said that, I was like, okay, this man is cut from the same cloth as me because I love walking. I walk for hours and hours a day. I can walk for like 12 hours straight and just have the most mind-blowing epiphanies while I'm walking. It's so relaxing. Have you always been a walker? What has walking done for you?
I've never owned a car and I'm 48.
Me neither. Oh my God. We are cut from the same cloth.
So if you don't own a car, you still need to get from A to B.
Yeah.
And I try often just to walk from A to B. So I've lived in cities where that is possible, whether that be New York or London or Budapest, but places where it is certainly doable, even at some cost. But Dennis, that's a 40-minute walk. Yeah, it's a 20-minute kind of subway ride, so I'm really just adding another 20 minutes. So let's just walk there. Now, I'll provide two walking stories or two reasons for why I walk, or ideas for why you can start to walk as well. I was on a call earlier today with one of our investors, and we initially, as I pitched him, walked from one end of San Francisco to the other. It took us an hour and a half, and it was a little bit out of the ordinary. Because usually you're supposed to come to the office, you're supposed to do the PowerPoint deck. And I took him on a walk. And to this day, and it must have been at least 4 years ago since we closed that round of financing with his firm, he talked about that particular walk. But the one thing that I keep reminding him of is that in this particular Zoom call we're having today, Vivek, if we say nothing for 30 seconds, that is very awkward. As in, if you and me just sit here and stare at each other for 30 seconds, I'm not sure, is this a date or is this an investor call? What is going on?
Yeah.
But if you walk with somebody, you're actually allowed to just kind of walk, take in the scenery, think, actually have a pause before you say something. In many other scenarios, that is socially unacceptable or socially awkward to the degree for where you try not to do it. So instead of saying nothing, you say something. And sometimes saying nothing is much better than what you had in mind right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that is certainly one of the things I like about kind of combined walks when I bring people with me. So that's one reason. The other reason is I do these very long walks on the weekends where I typically take the subway. I live on Wall Street. So I take it all the way up to the other end of Manhattan. And then I walk back, just kind of willy-nilly. No iPhone, no podcast, no music, no nothing. Just me, my thoughts. No particular agenda, no piece of paper. I need to go through these things. I want to have my mind wander. What happens is that I start out with all sorts of thoughts from really the prior week. And when I get back, sometimes I latch onto something and I'll think about it for half an hour, try to kind of solve it, and then I forget it, it comes back. But everything that needed to be put in a box, sorted out, cleaned up, I end up in that kind of 3-hour walk with a kind of cleaner mind that had all the things that kind of just weren't fully sorted out, fully sorted out. Things that are worth remembering for where I need to kind of do that when I get back. If it's that important, well, I'll write it down when I get back to the apartment.
Yeah.
So that's just a great end of week, almost kind of spring cleaning of your mind where you get to put things in the right boxes.
Oh my God. There's like 50 things you said that I just completely resonated with. The last thing you said, spring cleaning of the mind, I call it a mental detoxing. That's always been my word for it.
Yep.
To get those negative thoughts out of your head, the stuff that you haven't quite had enough time to think about and you're uncertain about, if you go for a nice long walk, you get this clarity. You just, it's like all the pieces fall into place. The puzzle sorts itself out and you just have an understanding. Okay, next week, here's what I have to do. I know exactly what I need to do. I know where I'm going. Everything's good. I'm not confused. I'm not overwhelmed. There isn't so much noise in my head. Again, mental detoxing.
We can add just a footnote to that. The added benefit, as I'm sure you probably mentioned in one of your other podcasts, is that, well, my 3-hour walk is 800 calories.
Yeah, good point. Yeah.
Yeah. Just a straight New York burger in my belly without any cost. It is awesome.
Yeah, I wasn't even going to say that, but that's another amazing benefit. Yeah, I used to be really, really overweight, pretty much obese, and I lost 35 kilos, like 77 pounds. And a huge way that I did that was by walking for like 10 hours a day, like quite literally 10 hours a day. And I used that process. It was over like a 7-month period of walking pretty much every day for like 10 hours a day. I almost entered this Zen state because I could meditate every single one of those hours. And man, I had some life epiphanies. I thought about like the meaning of life. Where am I going? What do I want? Why did I let myself get this unhealthy? Do I want to treat myself better? What kind of friends do I want? Do I want to look after my family more? All of these sort of things. I only had that because I had so many hours. When you go for a walk, it's like you have these hours dedicated to thinking. And I think that that's something that people avoid. We avoid being alone. We avoid thinking because we're scared of our own mind or scared of what we might uncover. I think we go through life kind of bullshitting ourselves a lot of the time. And when you go for these walks or when you give yourself some time to meditate and think, the bullshit that you've been telling yourself comes up. So you say like, okay, I have been kind of lying to myself about my diet. I thought I was doing okay with my diet, but I haven't lost weight for 5 weeks. And yeah, it's because I'm eating cheeseburgers every day. Okay, I've been lying. Or maybe you think I'm lying to myself about my relationship. I'm not really that happy in my relationship. I need to talk to my girlfriend or my wife or whatever, and we need to sort this out. You only have those epiphanies when you give yourself time away. It's like you can suddenly see the forest for the trees. You take a step back and you can look at your life and analyze it, almost like you detach from it. And you look at yourself and you say, am I happy right now? Am I happy with where I'm going? Am I happy with where I've been? Is there anything I want to change? And it is only from walking and also sitting on trains. I like to sit on trains and look out the window for the same thing. It's only when you have these moments alone, even just for an hour, that you get to take a step back and get some mental clarity. Another thing I'll say, I'm really into this idea of us being two Venn diagrams. At this point, I think like we have more overlap than not because this is cracking me up. One thing that my girlfriend and I do whenever we go on a long walk is we turn our phones off and we say the rule is you're not allowed to turn it back on unless it's an emergency. And if there's anything that we need to write down, like if we have some amazing epiphany or something, if it's that important, we will remember it when we get home. And if we forgot it, then it can't be that important. Another thing we like to do is we'll jump on a random bus or a random train and we have no idea where it's going. We'll just kind of jump off at any point as soon as we see something interesting, like maybe we like a building or we like the trees or that area looks interesting. We'll jump off and then without phones or anything, we'll kind of just wander around for hours and hours and hours. We'll find like little side streets that are interesting. Sometimes we'll get lost. Sometimes we'll go to a national park and wander around the bushland and stuff like that. But I think leaving the phone either at home or turning it off, I think that's critical to this. It isn't much of a walk if you're looking at your phone every 5 seconds. You may as well just be sitting on a bench looking at your phone.
Yeah. I think we are still trying to figure out where those little devices belong in our life. And you and me are the first generation. And I think we might have, at least in the beginning, stumbled a little bit. I actually find my kids more responsible sometimes than my wife and I, because they've grown up with them and have a more natural relationship with them. And I've really tried hard over time to change some of that behavior, which I disliked early on. Go back perhaps 5, 6, 7 years, where you were fully in love with the iPhone, where today I'm not in love with it at all. It's just a device. But yeah. I can certainly see if I go back how I misused that particular power in my pocket. And today it's just a device.
Because that's the opposite narrative that most people will say. Most people will say millennials, technically I am a millennial. Okay, most people will say the current generation of young people are obsessed with their phones more than anyone older is. And you're saying it's the exact opposite. And I can see an argument for that because you're right. You and I still can see, we can still remember the days when this technology didn't exist, when I didn't have a damn phone. And if I wanted someone, I had to call their home phone and hope they were home or leave a message or send an email. Sorry, email was even difficult because we had slow dial-up 56K internet and stuff like that. We can still remember that time. So we do still look at the technology and like a pair of boomers or something, we go like, oh my God, I remember in my day when we didn't have these smartphones. Isn't this technology beautiful? Whereas you're right, your kids will just look at it and be like, Dad, it's just a phone. You don't need to use the phone right now, Dad. You don't have to be obsessed with it. And you're like, no, but I do because I remember when I didn't have this. It's like we're clinging on to nostalgia or something.
Yeah, I'm not sure what it is, but I've certainly went out of my way to change my behavior years back, where on one of those walks, you end up, if you're really honest with yourself, just concluding that that's not a healthy behavior. You should change that. But it turned into a little mini addiction, right? For where you kind of almost walk around with it in your hand, like you're holding somebody's hand.
Yep.
And the whole thing is just crazy if you look at it from afar. And been super happy with how I changed that. But I just think it was a moment in time because we kind of got exposed to them at this very moment, didn't really know how to behave, made all the errors, and are trying to kind of correct for it now. And then the next generation will just see it for what it is, a dumb device that provides me a set of services, which I use when I need them and otherwise not.
Yeah, it's almost like you and I place too much value judgment on ourselves for even using the phone. Like I know that every time I pick the phone up, there is this background thought in my head saying like, oh, be careful how much phone you're using. Whereas you're right, people who've grown up with it will just say like, no, I need the phone right now to do this task. And as soon as it's done, it's done. There isn't caution around using it that there definitely is for me. Like I even use an app on my phone called Stay Focused. And what that lets me do is set a specific amount of time that I use each app for. And if I use it more than that, it will block the app and I can't use it. So I can't mindlessly check Facebook 50 times a day because it will only let me do that like 10 times. Whereas you're right, young people won't necessarily pick the phone up and have this back and forth tug of war, mental war with themselves saying like, no, I shouldn't be using my phone, but I need to, but I shouldn't be using it. Oh my God, but I need to. They just kind of go like, no, I need to do this task. Let me do this task. Cool, it's done. Okay, now I'm going to go hang out with my friends.
Yep.
There are exceptions, obviously. Like there are a lot of young people that will sit there on their phone, but that's like self-medication. That's a whole different story. So if people want to find your stuff, obviously x.ai is what you type into your web browser, your worldwide web browser, and that will take you to your calendar software. How can that help my listeners? How can they use that? Because I played around with it myself. It's pretty cool. What would my listeners get out of using that?
So anybody who walks into any office, whether another building or their bedroom, and runs a job on their laptop, is likely to be invited into meetings. They can open up their calendar. There'll be a set of events. Those events didn't arrive through magic. They arrived through some little negotiation. You shoot me an email. You ask me if we can meet up. I email back, and that ping pong. And it's not difficult to do that ping pong. As in, we've done that for years now. What we would rather see is us escape that. And what we've created is this set of intelligent agents, Amy and Andrew and Scheduler at X.ai, for where if you want to set up a meeting, you can simply CC them in your email and say, in natural language, hey, Amy, can you find some time for me, Dennis, and Andy for half an hour on Google Meet next week? We will then receive that email, understand that we work for you, and remove you from the dialogue, reach out to Dennis and Andy individually with a set of time options, try to drive that whole thing to conclusion, and upon conclusion, insert an event on your calendar. You can almost imagine it like you having somebody at your office helping you with your scheduling. And we have a free edition, so I'm not selling you anything here, so you can go kind of try it out on Exit.ai, and at least just for the fun of it, as in, what could I do if I had a little helper? Because when you see this little helper, I think you immediately kind of imagine, ooh, what other helpers could I then have? What other little chores do I not need to do? So that's what we've been working on, trying to remove this little office chore, and been on it for the last 5 years.
Yeah, it really is like just having a free virtual assistant. And like you said, it's free. And I think your free one lets you have unlimited. You can only have one calendar, right? But you can have like unlimited schedules and stuff like that. Especially if you're someone like me doing a podcast or anyone who has to schedule stuff with people. My calendar is like crazy. If you looked at my calendar, you'd say, oh my God, you need to clean that up. Something like this is way easier because I can just say like, you tell me when I'm free, basically. It's like you're palming it off to a virtual assistant. Like, you just do this for me. I can't be bothered.
Yep.
This stuff is free, like you said. You're not. It's literally free.
And what I like about it is that you can describe your constraints. So sometimes I'll say, Amy, find some time for Emmett and I on Skype for 10 minutes tomorrow. But other times I'll say, we should talk about that API integration. Amy, find some time in December for an hour on Google Meet. Because I want to be specific about when I meet people. Some things are urgent, some things are not urgent, some things are super short, some things are longer, some things need another two or three people in that particular meeting to get to a conclusion. So I want to be able to kind of describe that. Again, just like you would if you hired somebody to sit in the room next to you to sit and manage this on your behalf.
Yeah, I love that. Is there anything else you want to promote while you're here?
That is it. I only do one thing. I'm just the guy who tries to schedule meetings using AI. Nothing more, nothing less.
And a guy who likes to walk. Well, thank you so much for coming on. This was a hell of an awesome chat. It was really great to meet you.
Time well spent. This was fun. We should do this again in a year's time. Then we might have a new set of stories to share.
Absolutely, my friend. Absolutely. Thanks for listening, guys. And if you'd like to support the show, head to theinnerwinnershow.com/support. You can support me on Patreon or PayPal, or you can buy one of the products that I recommend. Adios, amigos.